It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The U.S. Department of Education has revamped its definition of professional degree programs.
A little-noticed provision in this year's federal budget reconciliation imposes stricter borrowing caps on federal student loan borrowers, and it's causing a wave of concerns among the nursing profession and other healthcare fields.
In nursing, the new measures could significantly restrict the funding that is available to students pursuing advanced degrees. Starting in July, students pursuing non-professional degrees will be allowed to borrow $20,500 a year, or a total of $100,000.
Nurses make up the largest segment of the healthcare workforce, and these changes come as Wisconsin faces a shortage of nurses that is growing.
To learn how the federal policy changes could affect our state's workforce and patient care, we have Gina Denick-Champion, CEO of the Wisconsin Nurses Association. Gina, welcome.
Well, good morning, and thank you for the opportunity for us to share what's going on at the Department of Education at the federal level.
Yes, and Jill Guttormson here as well, Dean of the Marquette University College of Nursing and a professor of nursing. Jill, welcome as well.
Good morning. Thank you for the opportunity to be here.
Gina, let's start with you. What does this reclassification mean for nursing students, especially if you want to become an advanced practice nurse?
It is a place where nurses that are pursuing their advanced degrees in nursing as a nurse practitioner, the nurse anesthetist, the nurse midwife, and our clinical nurse specialist, where they can depend on getting those loans, and also if they also could also get some loan forgiveness as a result, it's pretty significant. Our nurses that are in school pursuing these degrees, some are having to work almost full-time and go to school at the same time. That's just in order to pay for their tuition. And losing those dollars could have an impact on the health of Wisconsin as they are becoming utilized more and more in some of those areas where there are a significant amount of lack of healthcare providers.
Impact on the health of Wisconsin. Jill, turning to you, from your vantage point heading up a college of nursing, what is your reaction to this reclassification?
I have concerns that we have many students who are interested in pursuing advanced degrees. They see the needs in our community. I'm confident we can figure a pathway forward to serve the nursing students that will enter into our programs. But I share the concern that those students may be trying to work full time, which may limit their ability to be successful in these really rigorous programs. I have concerns of individuals that have been considered an advanced degree and given the restrictions on the borrowing amounts will opt not to. And so we are losing potential future nursing workforce. And I can have concerns about the time to graduation. These caps really impact those students that want to move through their advanced degree programs quickly and get out into their advanced practice. And for our programs that are year-round, full-time, those students quickly run over those annual caps and will be needing to go into the private market for their loans. And I think students will have concerns about doing that.
Could this change at all lower the graduation rates of RNs or have a ripple effect on registered nurses?
That's a great question. In our undergraduate program, this is a graduate designation, so for graduate degrees only. Mm-hmm. So this professional designation doesn't have an impact in undergraduate nursing programs, but Marquette and many others in the state have entry-level nursing that are at the master's level. Those programs are for students that have had a degree or a career in something else and want to come back and serve as nurses. Those are the type of programs that are year-round, high level of credits each semester, and often get people out into the nursing workforce within five semesters. Wow. And so there I do also share concern that entry-level nursing will also be impacted, and that's those nurses that are at the bedside in our clinics. Mm.
Gina, the nursing profession and other areas of healthcare have worked toward parity across health professions for many years, for decades. What does this decision say about the nursing profession when the education department doesn't consider nursing a professional education?
I think that this is what is hitting nurses pretty hard right now. The social media pretty much blew up over the weekend, where they were saying, what do you mean I'm not a professional? And this is the registered nurses. And then you have these advanced practice nurses who are, you know, working in those areas where there's a physician shortage, that are not being acknowledged at the federal level as a healthcare professional. So that's, you know, obviously one of the things that are taking place on social media right now, but it's to us, it's also the impact on the dollars that will be available. It's going to be hard to continue to pursue those advanced degrees. And in the education world, we need some of those graduate level nurses that are interested in being nurse faculty members and nurse educators. And with that amount of, you know, the rate of their investment in these programs and the decreased availability of loans will certainly impact the number of enrollments that we can have within our schools of nursing. Without that graduate level and that PhD and doctorate level, I think it's going to get tough for Wisconsin to continue to try and meet the demands that we have for nurses in Wisconsin.
That is Gina Denick-Champion, CEO of the Wisconsin Nurses Association. Jill Guttormson is here, Dean of the Marquette University College of Nursing, as we talk about the Department of Education updating which majors fall under the definition of professional degrees, nursing being excluded, and we're learning what it means for the nursing occupation in our state and for patient care. Jill, with Wisconsin's average federal student loan debt roughly $32,600 per borrower, but graduate student loan borrowers have a much higher average debt, often carry undergraduate debt. Could these loan caps pressure institutions like Marquette to reduce the cost of their advanced degree programs?
We're always incredibly committed. And at Marquette, and I know across the state, of thinking about how we provide high quality education at the lowest cost. It is incredibly challenging in nursing for some of the reasons that Gina mentioned. We need clinical experts teaching in our programs, and we need to be somewhat competitive with what those faculty can make within the clinical environment. It is a highly resource intensive type of training where small classes are required to ensure our students have the clinical skills that they need. So we agree about balancing cost and the quality of education, but we cannot compromise on ensuring we have the right faculty in the right classrooms, and we have the ability to do those really hands-on, high-intensity experiences with our students so they are prepared for practice. So it is a balance for sure.
Gina, your thoughts there. Would this prevent students from taking on unreasonable amounts of debt for the salaries that they can expect to receive in the workforce?
Well, I think some of that is already taking place, and nurses are, you know, as they graduate with their debt, you know, their ability to get that paid off is often just as up there with their household expenses. So it's loans, it's day-to-day living and purchasing of things that you need or items that you need for your household. So this will not help in those, you know, the graduate level, because where are we going to find the available faculty who see the return, like I said, their investment in wanting to work in a nursing education program? You know, there is quite a discrepancy in you know, the amount of money a nurse faculty member earns with the same sort of credentials, but are paid much less. And to think that you can lower tuition in a lot of those schools, it's just not going to happen because it is such a highly needed education for nurses. They need that one-on-one when they get into those clinical settings. And, you know, there are rules that talk about that. Accrediting bodies talk about that. So you want a competent, qualified nurse graduating. And that, again, depends on the supply of our nurse educators, too.
Jill, can the private loan market make up the gaps or be even sufficiently affordable, especially for students who have faced, you know, financial hurdles, economic hurdles?
I think that's a wonderful question. I do think that the private loan market will start to close that gap. My concern is the students who will opt out of pursuing because they don't want to take out private loans. Or, as you suggest, they're coming back to school to pursue a different degree or a future degree that will help them with financial concerns they already have. And then the private market will be an absolute barrier for them. We always also continue to look for scholarships and other ways to support students in our college. But we cannot close a gap without sufficient federal funds.
Jill and Gina, thank you so much for this update. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
That is Gina Denick-Champion, the CEO of the Wisconsin Nurses Association, and Jill Guttormson, Dean and Professor at the Marquette University College of Nursing. We've been talking with them about how recent federal education policy changes could affect Wisconsin's nursing workforce.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today, the gun deer hunting season kicked off over the weekend. Find out why Wisconsin has high deer numbers and a declining number of hunters.
That baby boomer generation is the strong deer hunting generation. I mean, they came into it and embraced it. And as they're retiring from deer hunting, they're just not being replaced in the same numbers.
That's ahead on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The gun deer hunting season in Wisconsin started Saturday, and the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources expects a record high population of deer in the state's forests and fields.
There are more deer, but fewer hunters. The number of hunters and licenses for white-tailed deer have declined steadily in recent years, making it harder to manage deer numbers.
We're checking in on deer hunting in Wisconsin and how state officials and local businesses are dealing with these changes.
Jeff Pritzel is the deer specialist for the Wisconsin DNR. He's set to retire at the end of the year after more than three decades of service. I talked to him last week. Give us a big picture, the state of Wisconsin's whitetail herd. What are our numbers looking like as far as we know in the state?
Well, the big picture, you know, statewide is that, you know, our deer population is robust. It's at least as strong as it was last year, if not even maybe a little bit bigger, because we're now coming off of two consecutive mild winters that can really have some influence, especially in the northern forests. And so, but even though we talk about relatively high deer numbers, we always have that dual story going on of the northern forest versus the farmland part of the state. And deer are just inherently unevenly distributed on the landscape. And so even though there's a high number, there's plenty of places where the local experiences won't reflect that.
Right. And I hear this, I think, every year, Jeff, hey, high deer numbers. And then there's some people, especially in northern Wisconsin, say, what are you talking about? We used to have tons in my neck of the woods, and now you hardly ever see them. And both of those things are true, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's two factors, and probably even more, that influence that perspective of, boy, I just don't see deer like I used to during the gun season. And, you know, one of those things in the north is that we've transitioned through what I would, you know, describe as a bell curve of a peak that came together because of a couple of conditions in the late 90s and early 2000s, and we're on the backside of that. We also have just seen this cultural shift in the way we go about our deer hunting. I mean, more hunters have adopted a more sedentary strategy where it's like, pick a good location and let the deer come to you, as opposed to traditionally where there was a lot more deer drives and the strategy was to get out there and get the deer moving. So it's reasonable that hunters could say, I don't see the deer like I used to see on opening weekend, but it doesn't necessarily mean the deer aren't out there. They're just potentially being distributed differently and moving differently. And our hunter effort has over time shifted a little bit away from the 9-day gun season into archery hunting. And so those things can make both things happen at the same time. We can have more deer on the landscape and actually see fewer deer when we're deer hunting.
Now, more deer, those numbers seem clear, especially as you say in the farmland area, but there's been a long-term trend, I understand, Jeff, of fewer deer hunters. What are we seeing over time?
As the baby boomer generation is retiring out or aging out of activities, you know, that's affecting, you know, deer hunting as well, because that baby boomer generation is the strong deer hunting generation. I mean, they came into it during a period of time and embraced it. And as they're retiring from deer hunting, they're just not being replaced in the same numbers. And so, and there's other things we hear about that happening as well. It's interesting to note that this year, the most common age of a deer hunter in Wisconsin is 64 years old. So that in of itself helps that picture of it's a matter of the demographics of our population. And so we've seen that trend start back at the turn of the century. In the year 2000 was our highest number of deer hunters in Wisconsin at 700,000. And we're now at 600,000. And even with all the promotions we'll do to try to keep people involved, it's pretty inevitable that a decade, 15 years from now, we're going to be probably looking at 500,000 deer hunters.
Hunting is one of our main deer management techniques in Wisconsin. What happens if we don't have enough hunters to hunt at the level that we use for herd management?
This is not unique to Wisconsin. Most of the Midwest states, we just mentioned how we've lost 100,000 hunters in Wisconsin over the last couple of decades. Michigan's lost 250,000 hunters during that same time period. And so, yeah, the question looking forward is, how will we position deer hunting as the premier management mechanism for that deer population? And so it is going to require a paradigm shift, because we're, even though we have fewer hunters, the hunters that remain are more avid. And so they probably have that opportunity to maintain that harvest capacity or even increase it. And that's really what's going to have to happen. We're going to have to see an increase in deer harvested per hunter. And it's not universal, because we have hunters that are positioned in very fortunate places and others that, you know, are a little more challenged because they're hunting in, you know, some suboptimal landscapes. And so getting the hunters that are in fortunate to be in the right position to probably recognize that they are not just hunting for themselves, but they need to take on that role of hunting for their community is going to be an important, you know, aspect in the future.
Are we at a point, especially in those farmland areas you mentioned, central, southern Wisconsin, where there are too many deer? And Jeff, I understand the phrase too many deer is probably going to start fights among some people, but is there a sense that we have too many deer in some places now?
Yeah. So, and really the source of that angst or that tension, Rob, is that when we talk about deer and deer management, there's always been this conflict of the scale that we're talking about it. So the agency, the DNR, is looking at a deer population at a unit-wide level or a county-wide level. We're talking about hundreds of square miles. And in that area, we can, you know, use calculations to estimate that, yeah, the deer density is too large for that particular area. But within that area, at the much more local level, at a per square mile, it could be vastly different from that. And so you will always have individuals that would say, that's not my experience. And they're not wrong. But, and that's why I say the challenge is those hunters that are find themselves in the situation where they are connected to those higher deer concentration areas really have to carry more than their share of the weight in terms of deer harvest, because there's numerous trade-offs and challenges associated with deer numbers being out of balance ecologically with the landscape, but then also out of balance with social tolerance because of the potential negative impacts we can see that deer can cause, you know, to other our own interests, whether that be property damage or crop damage or deer accidents on the roadways, those sort of things.
It's gun deer season in Wisconsin. We're talking to DNR deer specialist Jeff Pritzel. Jeff, you're retiring. This will be your last deer season in this post. You've been not at this post, but in this line for a good long while now. I want to talk some big picture stuff. You know, when I started here at Public Radio, there was this new story about this weird disease, chronic wasting disease, affecting Wisconsin's deer herd. How has that changed deer hunting in Wisconsin over the last few decades?
It certainly has had an impact, but the challenge with it is that perception of the role of chronic wasting disease has a lot of variability within the hunting and the general public and the full spectrum of people that are extremely concerned about it, to others that really, you know, are not concerned about it and actually are concerned that the focus on CWD itself is the problem. And so we deal with that full spectrum, which makes it challenging to actually kind of move collaboratively forward in a direction. But it has impacted, certainly as we look at the harvest history in certain counties, it has shifted both hunter effort and hunters' decisions as to when and where and which deer they're going to harvest. And we're starting to see an impact to the deer population in those areas where the disease has been around the longest.
Another change, the revival of Wisconsin's gray wolf population, a lot of things to talk about there. Very specifically with deer, though, people wonder, does having a sustained gray wolf population in Wisconsin affect how many deer there are and where the deer are? Do you see any measurable difference there?
Well, I would say as it relates to wolves, the thing that first we need to lay out is that there's no question that the presence of wolves on the landscape changes the deer hunting experience. And a lot of people understandably interpret that as, I don't see as many deer, again, going back to that, I don't see deer like I used to, and there seems to be a cause and effect relationship between the presence of wolves or the population growth in wolves and the decline in deer sightings. And that's understandable. But yes, the presence of wolves impacts deer sightability, but it may not be as much related to actually reducing deer numbers as much as it has changed deer behavior and distribution on the landscape. And that's where it's the bottom line is presence of wolves makes deer hunting harder, but it doesn't make it impossible. And as it relates to the direct relationship between the number of deer, the number of wolves, the real driving factor there is winter. And that's what we're seeing in the north right now. We're coming off of two mild winters. Deer populations are going to trend up. If we have hard winters, that tips the scale in the favor of the predators, and especially the wolves. And so there is this relationship. But the real question becomes, are those wolves consuming deer that were going to perish one way or another? And so when we have a hard winter, the scale's tipped in favor of the wolves. When we have a mild winter, it's tipped in favor of the deer. And that ecological relationship will just continue to play out. And we want to try to interpret it and what it means and find cause and effect relationships. But it's a complicated issue that doesn't have a simple answer. And so I'm sure we'll continue to struggle with that that connection and helping people kind of make it fit.
Briefly, as we wrap up, Jeff, you're in a tough job, right? A lot of controversial decisions, a lot of different constituencies. I get the feeling, hearing you talk, you still have enjoyed this work.
I definitely have. It's fascinating to me that actually the sociology of deer hunting, deer management, is what was my attraction to it. I I don't like the term deer specialist because there's a bunch of people in Wisconsin that know a lot more about deer than I do. But over my 35 years, I've gotten to know a lot of deer hunters, a lot of people that are policymakers, and I've really enjoyed how the cultural and social aspect influences this and blends with the biological part of it. And yeah, that's something I've always been intrigued by and have enjoyed. And frankly, I'll miss the people part of this.
Jeff, thanks a lot for joining us.
You bet, Rob. My pleasure.
That's Jeff Pritzel, deer specialist for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, with us today to talk about Wisconsin's deer herd as the state sees fewer hunters from year to year. Now we head out to the woods to get a better sense of what hunters are seeing in the state. Jared Flickinger is a hunting and fishing guide and owner of Rutting Ridge Outfitters in Buffalo County in western Wisconsin. Jared, thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me.
We just heard about, you know, a decline in the numbers of deer hunters around the state over time. Is that something you're seeing from your perspective there in western Wisconsin?
Yeah, I do believe with Jeff that, you know, a lot of things like that have changed. There's not as many youth out there anymore. And it seems like, you know, a lot of these kids just haven't been introduced to a lot of this stuff. And the numbers have definitely gone down, even in outfitting. Most of our people that we have coming are, you know, in the late 50s, early 60s that are out there hunting with us.
I know the DNR has done work over the years trying to recruit people who didn't grow up with hunting. Have you done any of that, or have you had at least some curiosity for people saying, hey, I didn't grow up with this, or maybe I did it once or twice, and now I want to get into it?
You know, I've tried to introduce that into the schools and stuff like that, but yeah, I mean, there are a few that we get that said, hey, I mean, I just had a call today that says, I've only been hunting once in my life and I just want to get into it and I want to get my kids into it. And so, you know, when we get an opportunity like that, you know, we want these guys to come. So we take these kids, tell them half price, you know, I want these kids in the outdoors because they are our future for, you know, getting out in the woods and protecting our deer and harvesting our deer. So you just have to educate everybody.
Jared, this is your business, hunting and fishing, but it also seems like a family tradition. Can you talk about your upbringing and how deer hunting fit into your life?
Yeah, I mean, when I was younger, you know, it was a family tradition. You know, every Friday night before hunting, everybody would get together out in the garage and, you know, and be, you know, talk about past misses and past hunts of everything that we've done. And, you know, as the years have gone by, a lot of the land around here has changed too, that, you know, we get a lot of absentee landowners now, and, you know, the family tradition just isn't there as much as it used to be. You know, it used to be that, you know, with a family tradition, a lot of these people would meet up at local bars or barn grills and stuff like that the night before. You know, they'd used to come out to the registering their deer and showing them off and stuff. But now with a lot of the online registration, you know, that took another part of the family get together out of the equation too. But, you know, we don't see it a lot. Like Jeff said, we don't see a lot of the families going out and doing deer drives anymore. The absentee landowners are coming from long distance away. There's only a few of them hunting. Some of the land has been, you know, divided up many, many times. And, you know, we've seen a lot of that stuff has changed in the last 20 years.
That's the numbers of hunters. How about deer? We heard, you know, northern Wisconsin might see fewer in some places, central and southern Wisconsin seeing a lot more. In your neck of the woods, what have you seen in recent years when it comes to, hey, are there deer out there for the hunters who are showing up?
Oh, there's plenty of deer, but, you know, it really depends on what part of the county you're in. Part of the county, there are a lot of small parcels. There are some parts of the county that have a lot of big parcels, you know, big family traditional farms and stuff. We see a lot of deer on the farms that are really big or have areas of really big ownership around it. Where we see farms and stuff that have been broken up into smaller 40s and 80s and stuff, we tend to see a little bit dip into the number of deer coming in. And that's because that pressure has been put on that 40 and 80 acres with, you know, the same amount of people that had on the big farms. So you see more pressure on the 40 and 80 acres that push those deer out to those big farms where there's less pressure on them. And I think, you know, the farms out there with the big farms, they have a buttload of deer, and you can see it just driving around. And by me hunting here for 20 years as an outfitter, I've seen the land on the south side of the county and the north side of the county.
What have you seen in terms of trends for, you know, people who do the gun deer season, which is still the big deal, versus, I understand, a growing number of people going in, the, say, the bow season? Have you seen that change over time?
Yeah, the archery season has changed, too. Now I'm seeing 50-50 with a crossbow. I've been seeing a lot more older people going out now, too, with a crossbow, because anybody can get one in the county. So it's been 50-50 archery versus crossbow with the people coming into camp. That's probably the biggest thing that I've seen change.
Now, suppose somebody's out there listening who's maybe never been deer hunting, or maybe they went a couple times as a kid, whatever, and they're thinking, you know, I'd like to get out there, probably too late this year to make a quick plan, but what's the best on-ramp into the sport?
Get into your local hunting club. You get into the hunting clubs that are in each city or each county, get in there, get some education behind you of going through the firearm safety program, get into that aspect first, and then start meeting some people so that maybe, you know, you build a relationship up with other people that will take you hunting. There's outfitters out there all through the county, all through the state, you know, they are willing to help you and teach you also. So those are the two different avenues that a person can go that just wants to get into hunting for the first time.
Jared, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us.
Yep, you betcha.
Jared Flickinger is a hunting and fishing guide and the owner of Rutting Ridge Outfitters in Buffalo County. He is with us today to share what he's seeing and hearing from deer hunters in western Wisconsin. Earlier, we heard from DNR Deer Program Specialist Jeff Pritzel about efforts to control the rising deer population in many parts of the state.
Coming up, meet a restaurant owner in West Bend who started a free Thanksgiving meal for the community over a decade ago, and it's taken off.
Someone who's making $1 million a year is sitting next to someone who can't afford, you know, anything. I think that's what Thanksgiving is supposed to be about.
Building community through a shared Thanksgiving meal, that's coming up next.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. With the economy lagging and food costs on the rise, preparing a Thanksgiving meal for a big table of family and friends, that may feel overwhelming.
But what if there are ways to simplify the big dinner and simply enjoy being in the company of loved ones? Our next guests offer two different options for making the holiday manageable, fun, and affordable.
Tony Cable is the owner and operator of the Norbert and the Orville in West Bend. For years, he's been one of many volunteers behind free community Thanksgiving dinners in the West Bend area. Tony, welcome.
Kate, thanks for having me. This is great.
Over the years, the community Thanksgiving dinners you organize, they've kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And last year's event fed around 1,200 people, I understand. When do you start cooking?
We actually start cooking, I would say, the end of September or right around maybe the first week of October. It's kind of a process. As you know, turkeys take a long time to cook, and not just, you know, the 3 or 4 hours in the oven. There's a thawing process, which needs to start to happen in our refrigerators, which usually takes between 48 and 72 hours. And if you want me to get technical real quick,
go for
it. They take, you know, 48 to 72 hours to thaw out. And then, you know, obviously we unwrap them. We season them. We get rid of the gizzards and the necks and everything else. And then we cook them breast down in hotel pans for about 3.5 to 4 hours. And we'll start that about 3 or 4 in the morning. We don't want to disrupt, you know, our regular prep service that happens at the restaurant. So we have to get in there very early every day. And, you know, if we start early October, we're cooking about two or three days a week, usually between 4 and 6 birds each day. Wow. After they come out of the oven at, let's say, 8 o'clock in the morning, then we have to let them cool because they're way too hot to handle. Because they're such large birds, they're usually we usually cook our like toms, so it'll be like 20 to 22 pound birds.
Wow.
Yeah, once they cool down, then we can debone them, and then we have to kind of let them cool even more. You don't want to do it when they're too cool, otherwise your yield goes down. The meat is more pliable and comes off the bone a little bit better at the 130 to 150 range. So they're still very hot. So we double glove up. And then once we have all the bones, then we have to kind of stockpile those. We freeze them. And then as we get closer to Thanksgiving, we have these massive 8-gallon stock pots. All the bones go into those. And in order for us to use everything, which we do in the restaurant business anyway, if we can, we take all of those bones and drippings and we make our stock, which will eventually go into the gravy that we make and all of the stuffing.
Wow. So number one, my takeaway, freezers are your best friend if you're starting this process in early October.
Yes.
And you're using the whole bird.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. In our industry, if you can use as much out of a vegetable or out of an animal, the better off you are. So, nothing beats real great turkey stock. I mean, nothing beats that. You can't buy another product that's going to produce, that quality of flavor. So it's very important that we stockpile all the stock, which, this year, I think we're going to end up with about 180 quarts of stock.
Oh, my goodness. How did this community Thanksgiving table get started? What is that origin story?
A few years before I started mine at the Norbert. So I opened up the Norbert in 2014. And right away, I wanted to do this free Thanksgiving thing. I was inspired by a woman who had kind of a similar thought process. Her name was Mary Kay Von Brendel. And Mary Kay lived here in West Bend. She has since moved to Tennessee. But even after she moved to Tennessee, she came back up here and was running it.
Oh.
So I ran mine at the restaurant for about, 6 or 7 years. And then I got a call in 2022 from Mary Kay. And she told me the story of her son being diagnosed with, I believe it was MS at the time. He has now since passed. Mm. And he was a young man. He was in his 20s. Mm. But this Thanksgiving that she was putting on with the help of volunteers and donations was going to be very difficult for her to continue to run. So she called me up and said, hey, would you consider maybe taking over what I've started, which was much bigger than the one that I was doing at the restaurant. We were only feeding about 250 to 300 people at the restaurant. And that was just, hey, we're just going to cook a bunch of turkey and put together a bunch of food. And whoever wants to come into the Norbert and eat for free that day, they can do it. What she was doing was on such a larger scale. Mm. So she asked me if I would help take over. Of course, I jumped at the opportunity because she was my inspiration. And, how could I say no to that?
Mm.
Besides, she was feeding so many more people. And the first thing I did was I called up one of my best friends. Her name is Kelly Sickler. And because in order to orchestrate all of the volunteering, all of the deliveries, all of the donations, I wasn't going to be able to do that alone. Mind you, I was also running 2 restaurants.
Yeah.
So
not enough hours in a day.
No. So Kelly and I put this together with the help of all of these wonderful volunteers. We kind of have a core group of people. I would say about 12 of them between the 4 churches. And that's what we do. And it's, trust me, over the next 6 days, it's just going to be insane.
Tell us about who shows up for these meals.
Everybody. I don't care if they're driving, a Mercedes or they had to get dropped off by a friend or a taxi. It is a community event. And that is, for me, that is, I don't want to say the greatest part of this because I have to admit the volunteerism and the people that come out of the woodwork for me is the best part. But a very close second is the fact that it is a community event, and there's no one we won't feed. And to get all these folks together, we try and make the setting as intimate as possible, which is a little difficult in a school gymnasium, but we get linens and, we've got nice flatware and plateware. I wish I could dim the lights a little bit, but there's table decorations and you're sitting at these long card tables, and you're just enjoying the company, of the people that you're with. That is a miracle in itself. When you walk up into that gym and it's full and, you know, someone who's making $1 million a year is sitting next to someone who can't afford to, you know, anything.
Your community becomes family.
I think that's what Thanksgiving is supposed to be about. So it's a great feeling.
Tony, thank you so much for joining us.
Of course.
Tony Cable is the owner and operator of the Norbert and the Orville in West Bend. If you want to join the community dinner, see WPR.org for details. And if you're hosting Thanksgiving at your home this year, Wisconsin Today has you covered. We turn to Patrick O'Halloran, chef and co-founder of The Deliciouser. That's a Madison restaurant and spice business. Patrick, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Hosting Thanksgiving, it can be really overwhelming for home cooks. What's the most important thing that people should keep in mind when hosting?
Well, I think when you're hosting any kind of event or party, you want to get as much of your prep work done ahead of time. I mean, when we're working in restaurants, one of the things we do, we have our order lists and then we have our prep lists. So I would encourage people to always work off of a list, and try to come up with dishes that won't keep you at the stove all day. You want things, side dishes that are ready to just pop in the oven, salads that can maybe sit a little bit. Charcuterie's become so popular over the years because it's something that you can make ahead of time. It's really beautiful and you can set that out. And I would say the same thing with a lot of Thanksgiving dinners actually happen kind of midday or in the afternoon. So I would say go with some low ABV beverages if you're with the family all day drinking alcohol. It's a long, long day. Also, I would say batching drinks is a really good one. So you have things in batches ready to go. So you want to be a host. You want to play host. You don't want to be a slave to the kitchen or to the bar side of things.
Patrick, how do you keep up with the dishes? Or what's your system for keeping an organized, clean kitchen where dishes aren't just piling up?
Well, it's the classic clean as you go situation. And it's always when you have these big gatherings, you have to enlist some help. So that's a really important thing. And this is a good way to get the kids involved. Kids love to get their hands in certain dishes. And if you can get them helping with, you know, dessert prep or making cookies, or then you can show them the whole process, which includes the cleanup, which is the dreaded part of the whole operation.
Turkeys are about 40% more expensive than they were last year. Food inflation, as we see, ticking up. If someone can't afford a turkey, what alternatives do you recommend? You, I know, have a non-traditional Thanksgiving.
Yeah, I'm known for not doing turkey. So I love to do things, you know, as a restaurateur, we cherish our days off because we spend so much time in the kitchen at our jobs. So I really love like eating tacos or put a slow pork shoulder in the oven all day and then turn that into tacos. A lot of times when it comes to Christmas Eve, we eat spaghetti carbonara, just a really delicious dish that we love and not traditional, but something delicious that we look forward to that is special to us as a family. But I think that, you know, with the cost of turkeys, especially if you're doing a smaller group, you can buy turkey breasts, you can buy turkey legs. You don't have to buy the full turkey unless you really need that Norman Rockwell picture.
Are there sides that you see, side dishes you see as essential, or which ones can people do without?
I mean, growing up, it was the classics. Corn mashed potatoes, gravy, all mixed together. Probably the green bean casserole. And my grandmother was famous for Jell-O's, Jell-O molds.
Yes.
And I inherited her lengthy recipe book of all of her different Jell-O molds, which I have never made.
Oh, that's so special, though. It's really...
I might have to return to it because she really was into the Jell-O mold. But I would think, you can go with all those classics, but I lean more into this time of year using things like apples and pears. I love parsnips so much. I think they are so underrated. And that I just said the other day, I think they're the king of the root vegetable.
How do you prepare the parsnips?
So we did a dinner Tuesday celebrating our fifth anniversary at the Deliciouser, and we used parsnips in a puree. We cooked them down with onions, garlic, and shallots, and then a lot of ginger. We have an heirloom ginger from Vietnam that's harvested in the mountains at altitude, and we made this very ginger-forward parsnip puree. And people who aren't familiar with the parsnip, it's kind of like that white carrot, a little bit starchier, but it has a tremendous sweetness. It almost kind of echoes like a sweet corn. I could see making an ice cream out of parsnips. It's just so delicious. So I'd lean into that. And of course, all the squash that are available right now. We work with networks of local farmers that we're blessed to have here in the Madison area. So little petite honey nut squash or the kabocha squash, all these different, the butternut is just a great versatile squash. I love an acorn squash. And spiced up, of course. And you can add different flavors to things like using curries that add a little element of a roasted squash simmered in coconut cream with maybe an Ethiopian-style curry, berberi, something that has all the warm spices that you think of in the fall, but also a little bit of heat.
Is there a particular dish, though, that you think people should really try? If they do go the traditional route, is there something that they could incorporate, maybe one thing that is brand new and different that would still be a good complement to a traditional dinner?
I mean, I do think that idea of all the different roasted squash as a savory application rather than just as the pumpkin pie at the finish would be great. Also, those different squash and pumpkin varietals make great soups as a little warm course to start with. And of course, there's a huge resurgence of Brussels sprouts. Every restaurant has them, and they have gone from, you know, blanched little boiled cabbages with maybe butter on them that we had when we were children to now all these different...
Teriyaki.
Deep-fried Brussels sprouts that are crispy with balsamic or even with fish sauce, vinaigrette, and Thai spices. So there's so many different ways you can go with the Brussels sprout.
This all sounds so good. Quickly with desserts, what would you recommend?
I mean, the classic pumpkin pie, I kind of feel like you have to have that, I think. But, you know, the apples and the pears are so good this time of year. And there's so many different varietals. And again, we're so blessed here to have all these different orchards that we can draw some, you know, heirloom varieties of apples from. And then the apple pie is great. But you can also, if you don't have a classic pie crust, a little crumble or a crisp, something with oats on top. And you can work with the different toppings, so then you can even do gluten-free there. So I think those are all great ideas. And I know down south, the sweet potato pie is also something that, that can find its way on to the table.
Oh, Patrick, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome.
That is Patrick O'Halloran, chef and co-founder of The Deliciouser. It's a Madison restaurant and spice business. And earlier, we heard from Tony Cable, owner and operator of the Norbert and the Orville in West Bend. And they offer tips on how to make Thanksgiving manageable, fun, and affordable. Wisconsin hosts some popular Christmas markets, including the European-style Old World Christmas Market in Elkhart Lake that opens next week, and the Christkindle Market in Door County, Sister Bay, that's going on now.
We heard from Norb in Sparta over the weekend, who sent along a beautiful photo of the Christkindle Market in Sparta. Norb writes, "It's a pretty amazing event for a small town. built around the bridges on Beaver Creek in the downtown area.
Thanks for telling us about it, Norb. And you can share about your favorite festive market. Is it in Wisconsin? Is it in Germany? Somewhere else? We can give a shout out on a future program. Email us at wisconsintoday@wpr.org, or you can call or text to get in touch. That number is 888-642-0232.
Wisconsin Today producers include Beatrice Lawrence, Lauren Cox, and Joe Tarr.
Our technical directors are Tyler Ditter and Sarah Hopeful.
Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kend. You're listening to WPR News.